Our next speaker is Anne O'Driscoll. Among many titles, the ones that count here today, the non-executive director at Steadfast and CommInsure, previously with IAG, a number of roles, including having to worry about a bit of capital from time to time, and before that CFO with Genworth, if I can read my own notes. Well, after that, yes. You know what I meant. That's the important thing. Please welcome Anne O'Driscoll.
Thank you. I've been asked today to focus on ICAP and related matters, so ICAP document or ICAP process, whatever process, that doesn't work, from the perspective of a non-executive director. So that's where I'm going to be focused. I will try not to repeat anything that's been said by the guys, so kind of changing what I'm said slightly. And I should say first that the views I'm putting forward are mine, not CommInsure's. Calm down. Are mine, they're not CommInsure's. So CommInsure, the two companies there, are the only ones I'm actually a director of at the moment. But in preparing for this, I have canvassed the views of a number of people who are directors and management of other companies to try and make sure that I've actually got a perspective that is actually just not mine and reflects the views of more people than myself. So, but most importantly, not CommInsure's. So I'm not going to talk about capital in that sense. We've talked about that. ICAP implementation, it was painful. And it was painful for all of you as actuaries. It was painful for the related management, the CFOs, and most other people. It was also painful for directors. It was very time-consuming. By definition, as a non-executive, an independent director of an insurer, you are a part-time resource, very much part-time. And the hours and effort that went into implementation of ICAP and related documents in proportion to the time expected of a non-executive director was massive. So, but was it worth it? And that's the real question. And while there are some gripes, and I'll enunciate a couple of them in a few moments, absolutely the outcome is positive overall. A benefit to the companies, to the boards, and a good thing. Maybe a bit too much of it, but a good thing. So, what has it done? Well, it has compelled more explicit but not new discussions. And I think that's important. I think there was a lot of discussion going on at management level, certainly when I was working in IAG and in Genworth as one of the members of the management team. It was part of our lives. It was part of very much of what we did. There were teams focused on it or people focused on it, depending on the size of the organisation. So it was very much there, but it wasn't always documented well. It wasn't always as well discussed at boards as it is now. So trying to evidence to somebody like APRA that we'd actually done all this, you know, they had outputs, but they weren't necessarily sure the quality and the discussion that went on around the inputs. So I think the discussions are underway, so they're expanded, they're more explicit, and they're documented. So that's a plus. Another plus related to that is they're actually working within what is an overall, a very, very good framework. So the concept of having a risk management framework, of having your appetite, and then of actually putting a capital process around that, having policies around that, having a process of implementing them, having a process of checking them, and actually having a process of having them reviewed. So there's a compulsion to have them externally reviewed at least every 3 years. That, you know, in some ways can be looked at as rather painful. In other ways, if you're sitting in one company as an executive, less so if you're on a board, because if you're on multiple boards, you only see that company's perspective sometimes. Sometimes groups like actuaries exchange views and you get some sense of it. But as a director, having that external perspective of what's best practice and how do you measure up and getting some input about that, while it can be expensive, it is actually of value, because even APRA's feedback can be specific to your company, but more generally when they're giving comprehensive feedback, it's anonymised so that you don't actually know where exactly you sit in it, so you have to sit there and go through line by line and check it. One of the criticisms that APRA comes out with is that some of the documentation they've been sent looks like a checklist to the extent of line out of the standard and how do we comply with that. I don't approve of that as a way to do it, because I do think I agree with Stuart, it is about the internal process and not a checklist. One of the gripes would be that if you don't actually be able to demonstrate how you comply with the standard, some relatively junior member of your supervisory team from APRA is probably going to tick it off against the guidelines anyway, and they effectively become mandated because back they come with a requirement or a recommendation depending on the extent of the gap. So I think there's a frustration there that is somewhat inevitable. I think APRA were frustrated when the industry kept asking for views. You know, what do you want? What do you want in this document at the beginning? And they were pushing APRA for guidance, which came out relatively late in the piece before the implementation deadlines. So I can understand the companies coming from that perspective, and I can understand APRA's frustration. So that evolution of how we get to what we're going to have in these documents is troublesome, and it is part of the difficulty of implementation. It's also part of what the evolution is going to be as these documents settle down, but at the same time, they have to remain living documents. One of the frustrations as you go through that evolution is the extent of the duplication that APRA force. And I sometimes feel that APRA make us put something into a document just so that they don't have to pick up the other documents. As a director, I end up sometimes being confused about where actually all this is, because I've got that and that and that. Now, which document? I know I've read this, and I know it's in what we do, but can I prove which document it's in? And sometimes it's in multiple documents. And when you actually make a change, so when your risk profile changes and you want to update the documents, you need to update the documents, you lose too much focus on actually making sure that all these bits, because the summary of one document is in the next document. You know, we have this definition in CPG 1110, paragraph 41, that says the document, the risk, the ICAAP summary statement has to be relatively standalone. I think it's relatively standalone, I think is the wording. And that is relative to what? We don't actually know. But effectively means you need to repeat these other documents in repeat summaries of them. So if you start changing the other documents, you have to change the summary. What you really should be focusing on, we've changed the risk profile, what is the implication of that really for our capital? Not what's the implication of the document of summarising this versus that. We really need to be focusing on what needs to change in the other document and not getting distracted by making sure these document references all line up because we've summarised one and the other. They should be more standalone. That would make it easier for everyone, but there's less paperwork, less hours of editing just for the sake of editing, and more focus on actually what's real, what needs to change, because that's what's important. The foundation documents are there, and they really need to be what we focus on. Andy has addressed the increase in modelling. I think that's a great thing. I think as a director, we are going to be driving and asking for more investment in models to get both outcomes that Andy referred to, an improvement in the quality of the decisions and an improvement in the models. In the final parts of Andy's discussion, was talking about the linkage of the different aspects. I think that's crucial, and I think that's part of what the framework that APRA have set up is trying to drive, part of what the modelling is trying to drive, and absolutely what you need as a director to have that overall responsibility that you carry to enable you to meet your duties and meet your responsibilities. However, as actuaries, you're very good at quantifying risk and quantifying outcomes. I think, and Andy did refer to it as well, and Stuart did, about scenarios. It's important, I've sat in board meetings as an executive and as a manager where there's an outcome that says it's a 1 in X chance. And when there's a 1 in X chance of the Sydney Basin being wiped out by an earthquake, that's not something that's easy to relate to. But at least if you have the discussion around, is it reasonable for us to fail if the Sydney Basin gets wiped out? Possibly, depending on your view. What does it take to make you fail, and is that reasonable? So Stuart talked about, and Andy talked about, reverse stress testing. Great thing. What does it take to make you fail? Interesting discussion from a board perspective. What is your appetite for that? Is it reasonable to fail in that circumstance? Because actually, knowing that you can fail, everyone knows you can fail, but where is it reasonable and where is it not reasonable? And that's a tough discussion to have, and that's not an answer out of a model. Models can help you go there, but you absolutely need to have the discussion. I also think scenario testing is wonderful. I think having great DFA models, and when they've been presented to me over the years, it's about, okay, so we've got this. What does that look like? What does the market look like in that condition? What's happened in investment markets? What's happened? What cat has happened? You know, if you have the big Sydney earthquake, then you're going to have an impact on financial markets in this state. So that's going to impact you. How's that going to run through? If you have it when we're already in a stressed economic condition, you know, we don't have the same backup for our investments, how does that play out? That kind of discussion is so valuable. And APRA, I think through the ICAP process, APRA has elevated the degree to which that is happening at the board. And I do think that's important, and also the responses. One of the firms involved in a review of something recently referred to fire drilling, having a fire drill. So if you reach this point where your target capital is encroached, where your PCR is in danger, those kind of issues, then absolutely, knowing what your response is going to be and effectively having a fire drill, how exactly would we go about doing this? What would it involve? How ready are we? Is this something we can pull off the shelf effectively as a skeleton and go for it? So I think that's all very important. So I do think we've got a lot of benefits out of this process. It is time consuming. It does deserve improvement as we evolve and as we sped these things down and make them more real. But we have overall a plus, and from a director's perspective, I think it helps directors sleep better at night to know these things are more under control than we did before, but there's still a way to go. So thank you.